Yet, a recent study found that many district attorneys lack basic policies to guide their core duties as prosecutors in Oregon. Join us May 20th on Prison Pipeline as ACLU of Oregon reveals their findings and promotes House Bill 3224 that creates transparency and accountability for Oregon's district attorneys. That's Prison Pipeline, May 20th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall. Bodie Phelps was 22 years old when two Gresham police officers shot and killed him on May 24th, 2016. The gathering remembers Bodie Phelps with speakers, flowers, candles, and protest against police murder. Again, that's Bodie Phelps Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall, 1333 Northwest Eastman Parkway in Gresham. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland. Coming up next, more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste.
Good morning. Today is May 20th, 2019. It is the 20th, right? Or the
yes.
Okay. And you are listening to More Talk Radio. And this is Cecil Prescott. I'll be joined with my guest, my co-host, Celeste Carey. But in the meantime, we all have the opportunity to have a conversation with Tess Kalker, who is the poet of the Northwest, not just the Pacific Northwest, but Northwest Ireland, right? Of
yes.
Ireland. So the poet of Northwest, we can talk more about
yes.
that.
County Sligo.
Right. Tess is, her most recent book of poetry is entitled Is Not. And she, and I think we wanted to interview you because Celeste saw this volume and
right.
she said, oh, we have to have you with
oh,
us. And
I'm so glad.
Such a pleasure for you to be able to join us this morning.
Yes.
Indeed. I went to the University of Missouri and I studied poetry under two people. They were married at the time and one of them was Larry Levis, who was a
oh,
student
I knew
of
him well.
Ted Hughes.
Yes.
And Marcia Southwick,
uh-huh.
who was his wife at the time.
Yes.
And I remember learning you as one of the confessional poets.
Oh.
But you're not mentioned as a confessional poet. And by confessional, it was those who, in the 50s and 60s, kind of created an American style that was centered on experiences that they had themselves
yes.
In a poetic sense. But reading this book, looking at some of your other poetry, I would say not only are you a confessional poet in that you take the human experience and you distill it, and you distill your experience into the human experience, both as an archetype, but as, I guess I would say, as the every person.
Yeah, I try.
Well, no, this book, some of the poems just took my breath away. I just felt like, as people said, this poem defies linear time. In mm-hmm. reading it, I felt as though not only did it take my breath away, but I felt like these are those crystalline moments in time we try to really live in when we say we want to be mindful or be present in the moment or whatever. And the one where you're braiding your mother's hair by the ocean.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, my goodness. I just felt like all the air left my body, but not in a bad way, but like I diffused into the universe.
Oh, good. Yeah, that poem is, I'd taken her there. She was not very well, and she had this long hair. She's part Cherokee and part Irish. In fact, this book, I went to read it in Ireland, in Galway, and I was right near where the Irish side of her family came from, Spittle. But she had this beautiful hair, and I, of course, when I was young, it was black, black, black.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was braiding it in that poem, which comes fairly early in the book, I think,
yes.
Of course, it had turned white. And should I read that, maybe?
Yes, please.
Since we're talking about it. We all have these moments that we stumble on in our lives, and but that we don't claim. And I think this is me going back and actually claiming a moment.
Yes.
Almost lost moment, coming back in an incidental way. Claiming to be the most beautiful moment of my life, braiding her waist-length white hair by the Pacific at La Push, hand over hand, the three-way crossings of apportioned strands, and quiet, her head braced against my gentle pull as she gazes out, both in our sea minds, and quiet, quiet.
Mm.
It's hard to get things to come into that really intimate space of two people near the sea. What's being near the sea does to you.
Yes.
You know, that you have that huge power there. Right next to you.
It's a huge primal energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a very intimate entity, like you said. There's nothing else that can come between you.
No. You're just there with each other beside that. Yeah. And clinging to the moment, holding the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Being able in the poem, that's this poem's job is to still that. And we were talking earlier, Cecil and I, about handwriting.
Yes.
And how our mother's handwriting was so could so bring them back. Just seeing that type of penmanship that was taught in those days.
Yes.
And I didn't mention to you that I had a long correspondence with my grandmother.
Oh.
And her handwriting was just another notch. Beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. And luckily, I saved all of those letters. And I can go back and read what my grandmother wrote to me. And I thought that's so important. I wonder if children have it today, correspondences with their grandmothers.
I wonder, you know, we were talking about penmanship and the how people write. And you remember when you were in school, the chart on how to write.
Yes.
I imagine it's a lot different these days. And just the fact that how we communicate with one another, certainly not by longhand if we communicate at all.
That's right. Very rare to get a handwritten letter now.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. We are speaking with poet Tess Kalliker, whose most recent volume is Not. It's a fascinating volume. And, you know, while reading this volume, I said, I finally got to the afterword, and I said, oh, maybe I should have looked at this at the beginning. But, yeah.
You can read it either way.
Okay.
I actually had to kind of fight for that afterword. Mm. It was delivered in Spain as a talk, and I presented it to my editor rather late in the game with the book. I had the book ready in about 5 years, and then I had to wait for 3 years for it to come out. And then I began to think, when I wrote that as a talk, well, this is what I must have been waiting for, because that essay does describe the kind of life I've been living, which is a back-and-forth life to Ireland and this specific area called Ballindoon, the parish of Ballindoon, about 40 miles on the border of County Roscommon and County Sligo. And that's where I went during the Vietnam War. My first husband was in that war. And I was kind of taken in by this family, the McDonoughs. And they were related to Josie Gray, who became my companion for 25 years. And that intensified this pilgrimage I kept making to this place of Ballindoon, where there was a beautiful abbey, and where, when I was writing my second book, Under Stars, I put a caravan up there. That's a trailer house in American lingo. Mm-hmm. And I wrote Under Stars, and I've had, I knew almost nobody in that graveyard at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And later, of course, now, Josie, my companion, has passed, and the young girl who was 12 years old, who came to bring tea and listen to the poems I was writing, she has passed too early, I might say. And the fellow that, you know, rented me the caravan, Tommy Flynn, who is a local character, he's there. And the first friend who welcomed me there, Josie Gray's sister, she's there. So I walk there now every day, and I sing to everybody. I figure there hasn't been enough song in that graveyard, because Cromwell came through there and shot the monks, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of the use of the abbey, and it's now a ruin. Mm. But this is what the backstory and the afterword, this essay, talks about. But also my ideas about time.
Yes.
You know, how I have this feeling that I'm trying to catch up to things that haven't exactly happened yet. A kind of feeling of prescience.
I like that.
A forward echo that I'm traveling in.
It's almost as though you're trying to see behind a reflection, see the wholeness,
yes,
in stillness.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's two things that step out to me when you say that. One is recognition. That last line did it for me. It was one of those moments that spoke to, there's a poem, and I cannot remember the poet's name. I want to say it's Mark Strand, but I don't think it is. Keeping Things Whole.
Oh, yes, that is Mark. Yeah.
Okay. I moved to keep things whole. And
yes.
In reading Recognition, which speaks to how we understand what whole really means.
Yeah.
Whole is not just having all of its pieces. It's the way it also functions in the space and in its own reflections, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poem, Staring Down from the Bridge at the Moon, Broken Up in the River. Who could know without looking up? It stands whole above its shattered self. And when I saw that, And then when I read this paragraph in your afterword, you were to be a poet. There was nothing else. You know, you talk about the American Northwest pulling you. I used to jokingly say I was going to live in the Northwest. North drew me like a magnet as a kid. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about being on the water and how light illuminates the mind on water and the motion of the boat is a lullaby, a natural state of meditation, speech on water is changed and intimate, which is like the relationship with your mom doing your hair. Mm-hmm. And then the mind drifts. Life is bare to essentials. When you're on the ocean, one feels in touch with sacred space and nonlinear time. And then you say, it was all perhaps a preparation for becoming a poet, surrounded by the unknown, daring to venture and to pass back and forth from the wild to the domestic of home and hearth, all the while watching the larger-than-life efforts of your parents. And mm-hmm. it's though that whole travel, the whole life you led, the whole way you got lost in the oceans of the stars, mm-hmm. is as though you're translating this big celestial song into these crystalline words. I don't know any other way to say
it. Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
I don't know any other way to say it. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what made you decide that poetry was indeed where you wanted to go.
Well, I was writing poems from about age 14, and I didn't know exactly what it was because, of course, I wasn't going to meet any poets in Port Angeles at that time. But now, of course, there are a lot of poets there. Mm-hmm. But I went to, I had one high school teacher, Margaret Matthew, and she had no children. So she was really within reach. Somehow, because she didn't have children, she was there more for us somehow. Mm-hmm. And so I really connected with her, and she brought in the Atlantic Monthly to our classes in high school, and I got to see there were living poets, and they were rather difficult to get on board, but she helped make them accessible. So I started to write a lot more during that time, and then I, when I was 17, I went away to University of Washington. And there I tried to get into Theodore Retke's class, and I did manage it. I couldn't believe my name was on the list. We had to turn in our few poems, and then he chose 12 students to be with him. And I felt so fortunate.
Wow.
And that was, you know, I think having him as my first teacher, it was end game. I mean, you just couldn't be anything else. You had to be a poet because he was so impressive. Mm. And we were studying with him inside a library. It was a small poetry library, and he would just dance up and grab a volume and start to read to us from it, you know, to illustrate something he was trying to teach us. And some days he would just turn us out onto the campus, you know, and say, go out and write as many lines of iambic pentameter as you can and then come back. Mm-hmm. Well, then we would have to read them out.
Amazing.
And he had us memorizing, understanding that poetry was there to sink into your inner core and what the memory was. Try to illustrate it and try to show you how hard it was to remember some kinds of poetry and to get images in, to get story and drama. I think that's what I learned from that. I was an awful Wallace Stevens fan, and I remember reciting The Idea of Order at Key West for him at that time.
You're listening to KBOO More Talk Radio. Our guest this day is Tess Callagher, a poet who the most recent volume is entitled Is Not. Earlier we had mentioned, and in this conversation, we're talking about how your origins in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. but also Northwest Ireland,
yeah.
Where you spend part of your life as well. And earlier we had mentioned, you know, your experiences, and you mentioned the issue of abortion and what happened in Ireland,
yes.
and what's happening yes. here in the United States
exactly.
with all these laws suddenly. And why
yes.
don't you share something?
Yes, I have written several poems that are included in Is Not. One of them is about Japan, and that is, there's a poem in there called Daylong Visitor, about how the Japanese women would be pregnant, and then if they had a child to deliver, especially a girl baby, they would have to just go home and have that child on their own, and then that child was not going to live. And that's why it was called a day-long visitor. And then they would have to go right back to the fields. Mm. And so that poem is in this book. And then I was working on a book called Boogie Woogie Crisscross with a Japanese-American friend of mine, Lawrence Matsuda. At the time I was working on Is Not, and the beginning poems. And we had an exchange about Minidoka, where he was born, in the internment camp, Japanese American internment camp. And so this poem starts out there talking about that. I want to read this. It's called Button Button, which is a childhood game that we used to play, you know, who's got the button, and that searching that we do. For how to locate what's important. And in part of this poem, I'm talking about an East Indian woman named Savita Halappanavar. It's a beautiful name. And she came to Ireland as a dentist from India, and she had a pregnancy, but it was judged to be an untenable pregnancy. It was not going to live, this child. Nonetheless, the laws in Ireland at that time were such that when she went into the hospital, they said they couldn't take her baby from her, even though it was going to be very dangerous for her. They had to wait until the heartbeat of the baby stopped. And that's very dangerous for the woman, because the baby did die inside her, but they didn't tend to her, and she died of sepsis. And this struck Irish people very keenly, and they really resisted what had happened to her. And that was true in India. India reacted, and in Europe. And Ireland had a lot to overturn, because the Catholic Church had very much gotten the laws into a place where it really was not helpful to women at all. You couldn't have an abortion if you had been raped, or you know, if your father, for instance, or male relative had sex with you and impregnated you. But all of that was overthrown by this single death. It shows you the power, and it's just such a hardship that we had to lose her. But it's even been said now that the new law, which came forward in May 2018, should be named for her, because it became such a crime. But I just read you this, if it's okay.
Yes.
So Larry Matsuda is the Larry I'm talking to. Thank the Berkeley Antique Emporium sincerely, Larry, for the 1960s abortion now button, though I could not wear it with impunity to the Strand Hill Ballroom of Romance, even having readjusted the baby bump pillow in my trousers when I glimpsed the priest and ducked into the ladies. There a 14-year-old held out a crisp bag, collecting spare change to get to England on the boat for her solution. Cut marks in a ladder up her arm had failed to convince a judge her life was in jeopardy, her attempts so amateurish. Ah, you'd have to slice a jugular, and sure, what would be the point? You'd bleed out then and there, she sighed and thumped my pillow as if she'd like to take a nap. I dropped a 50-euro note and skint past her belly. On her neck, a cameo of Savita, secured by a black velvet band. Savita, Our Lady killed by a heartbeat. Savita, who took her degree as a dentist in India, then came to die of sepsis and neglect in a Galway hospital, an untenable pregnancy gone wrong, her care put aside for her child's vanishing heartbeat. Take my child, she'd pleaded earlier, to no avail, as she traded her heartbeat for her dying baby's silence. Savita, Savita, Our Lady of long suffering, who believed her death would not be required. I drop my not a banker button into the crisp bag, and Savita smiles shyly from the girl's neck, as if she knows her husband is taking her death all the way to the Court of Human Rights. Which he did. He took her death there to be adjudicated. Yeah.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 in the Portland area, 91.9 in Points East, Hood River and along the Columbia River Gorge. In the Willamette Valley and Philomath, it's 104.3. And of course, everywhere, it's KBOO.FM. Cecil and I are speaking today with Tess Gallagher. This is about her latest book of poems and thoughts and crystallized words, Is Not. Join us in conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And chat. Yes. You know, it was really interesting reading that you knew Roger Shimomura. He lived in Lawrence, Kansas for a short while. And my best friends that I used to go and visit were his next door neighbors and had some of his paintings. And I was just thinking, wow, what an intersection.
Yeah.
I also read, reading your poetry is one of the reasons I wanted to go. I wanted to go to the writer's workshop. Oh, I wanted that so badly. But it just never happened. It never happened. But that was where I thought I would meet my destiny.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have been there, I think, except for Mark Strand.
Mm-hmm.
He came to the UW and was teaching there from New York.
Ah.
And he just lifted about five of us out of his class and just said, I'm going to make it possible for you to go to University of Iowa to the writer's workshop. Wow. And I remember feeling, wow, that's a long way from the Northwest, you know. And he was saying, telling me stories about how it was so cold there that the water froze in your nose and you'd have icicles hanging from you. He was being funny with us. But I went to David Wagner, who had also been my teacher there, and he said, I don't have anything else to teach you, Tess. You might as well go. So then I worked for a year in Seattle for a blind man. Jerry Caraveau was his name. And that's the blind man that became the hero of Cathedral, a story written by my late husband, Raymond Carver. So if I hadn't had that delay and needed that money and went to work for Jerry, we worked for the police department in research and development, and we were developing a fingerprint retrieval file system, which, of course, you know, they have much more advanced things, I'm sure, now.
Now, yeah. No, now we're doing facial recognition.
Yeah.
Whether we want to agree to that or not.
That's right.
The title, Is Not.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a poem in itself?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a koan in the Buddhist sense. I think the comma is important. Is, comma, is not. That they're really neighbors. There's no period there. They partake of each other, and it's a conversation. And I don't know what it means in any definitive way. I think that's the way of conversation. You know that you're working things out, but you might not end up with a conclusion. And so that's a flag that's flying over the book. But you don't know exactly. But it's really the whole story, isn't it? I mean, that we live in this very intense is, this now, and yet we're also very involved in the is not. Everybody who has meant anything to us is also present. You know, I'm carrying Ray. I'm carrying my late companion, Josie Gray. I'm carrying this mother I read the poem earlier for, and my father was talking with Cecil about him, and he was a longshoreman and also a spar tree rigger, very dangerous work in the woods of the Northwest. And of course, all those friends who are now at the age I am, leaving, wonderful poets like Tony Hoagland, who was a student of mine, and Linda Gregg, who was on the trail with me, a whole generation of the older poets. You know, Stanley Kunitz was a mentor to me. He's in my is not, but he's very much an is too, because he was a mentor. And Buddhist influence, Jakjo Satuchi-san in Kyoto, she's still living and she's in my is. But I haven't seen her for quite a while, so she's kind of verging on the is not.
As you were sharing just now and talking about how these people and experiences are is and is not, and I think somewhere, maybe it's in the afterwards where you talk about the influence of Buddhism in your thoughts and the urgency of now. Could you say a little bit more about how that reflect in your writing and in your life?
Yeah, I kind of shun dichotomies, and yet the title is a kind of seeming dichotomy. So I don't throw them away entirely, as Buddhism will tend to do. I think having that crispness of the two things set against each other is also innervating. I like in Buddhism the valuing principle of meetings. That's also Irish, much in Irish culture, that when you meet someone, it's a kind of a universe that you're taking on, and it's such a gift, you know, and to be able for those meetings, and to enter authentically. I remember something that Alejandro González Iñárritu, the great Mexican filmmaker, said about meeting Josie. He said he was an authentic presence. And I think that's what Buddhism really asks you to do, is to become an authentic presence, however you manage that, you know. And one thing in my poems that I do get to, I think, is an overlapping of realities.
Yes.
Where things belong to each other instead of being compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. You come to this wholeness through this overlappingness. There's a poem, I think it's called Cloud Path, which actually enacts that. And we could show the listeners how that works, if I can find that poem. Cloud Path, yeah, 105 in the book. And it comes in right at the ending. I kind of sneak up on it and drop it in on you right at the end, you know. And I was talking last night at Powell's about how my neighbor in Ireland, Michael Henry, who was raised in the cottage that I have there, how he waved to me and said, Tess, I got your poem off the internet from the New Yorker. And, I just love those last lines. And then he quoted me the last lines, wow. And here he is, this farmer, you know. And I'm just so sure that probably wouldn't have happened in America. I had to go to Ireland and live in this cottage and for this farmer to say the end of my poem to me. So I live on right off an avenue that leads down to where the fishing boats are in Ireland. They're on this lake, Loch Arrow. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, they turn these boats upside down. So you'll know the season that I was approaching it during the winter. Cloud Path. With steps freshened by wearing a man's cast-off shoes, I follow the rain-rutted road as far as the fishing boats turned upside down on the soggy bank, their oars secured elsewhere to provide against thieves. Mottled light through waterside trees over the bows and sterns means trading fish for birds. I take up the invisible oars put by for just this occasion, a banishing scald of sun blotted inexactly by a succession of wind-blown clouds able to lift the entire flotilla. A bird flies through me, then a fish. So you have to discover that I'm looking into the water there,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that the fish and the bird get to join each other there, because I'm looking down.
Yes.
My mind finds them.
It's like you're capturing the energy that exists when you hold to not necessarily contradictory but opposing thoughts, ideas, concepts in the head, and you know what we call it, cognitive dissonance. But mm-hmm. cognitive dissonance, it doesn't have to mean that it's an uncomfortable thing. It's just the energy that exists between is and is not,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you capture it so perfectly.
Yeah, that's the conversation there happening right in the way that poem comes down, I think.
Mm.
That's one of the things I'm doing is looking more at joining, you know, how do things join, but also how one can be left out and purposefully left out. I think these times that I'm going to Ireland and leaving, I will be left out. It's a different culture. And I think it's a good practice to endure times when you are left out and you don't you don't know anything except watching and attending that difference. And I have the poem Encounter, in which that happens to me, and you feel very, very alone and lonely. It's an uncomfortable solitude. A lot of times solitude can be productive, mm-hmm. But sometimes you're just alone. And so I find I often seek out animal companioning at that time. And would you like to hear this poem?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's called Encounter. Again, I'm going down that same avenue. And Josie had horses that he kept at this big estate, which was just let to him at this stage. He had owned it, but he was making use of it for pasture at this time and didn't own it. Encounter. Over the rain-rutted avenue, I've walked to horses at Kingsborough, neglected estate, now plundered by gatekeepers, the twisted arms of rhododendron, hacked for firewood, the locals' mild compensatory salute. It's grand to finally see the lake. I hold my palm to the muzzle of a mare, her deep eye that sinks me in, its richly fringed lid closing over my reflection, then lifting me like an emissary of unknown offerings down corridors burnished with inklings of hounds and masters, drops of port spilled from a flask onto her neck, or Cromwellian plunder of silver dug into the pasture while the horses, unbridled, gazed on. She snuffles my empty hand, then tosses me and history into her farthest cavern. She'll keep me for the contraband I am, a lonely walker who doesn't know what she wants in a borrowed land, far from home. A small entitlement of steps led me to mystery, seeking to be left out. How else let difference tell you what you are? So yeah, that's an example of productive self-absence, where you're totally there to be taught and to take in your difference. I think of so much when I'm in Ireland about America, you know, the things that are happening in America. And of course, people come up to me and say, what about what's going on there? What about this government? You know?
As if we could affect it some way.
Yeah. No. And I think we do, you know, just each of us in our own personal holding and speaking out and trying to affect with our own whole being.
Do you think I don't know if better, but different insights in terms of, you said when you're in Ireland, people ask you about the United States, and I suppose when you're United States in terms of Ireland, do you get a sense, do you think that you have a different understanding of experience of the country, whether it's Ireland or the U.S., of having experienced both?
Yes, well, I'm part of Europe, you know. Ireland is part of the EU, and so I identify in both places, really. You know, it being in the EU is not with us. They are not with us on most anything. And so there's an assumption, because I am in Ireland with the people who ask me about America, that I'm thinking European.
Uh-huh.
And of course I am, but I also am in my heart, you know, wondering and wishing otherwise for my country, and trying to, when I do come home, affect that, you know, just like reading Button. I don't want Alabama, women in Alabama and in Missouri, to be suffering. And yet they're connected to women in the north of Ireland who, unlike the women in the Republic, do not have freedom of their bodies to seek the help they need when they're in a misbegotten pregnancy. There are 27 women in Northern Ireland every day that pack their bags and fly to England, because that's, again, the only recourse for them.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. We're speaking today with Tess Gallagher, poet, distiller of wisdom and words, about her new book, Is Not. You're welcome to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187. Now, it's 8:45. Don't wait till the last minute. If you've got a question, let it spring forth.
Excellent. I think I read an interview with you, I don't know where or when, but a while ago, and I think you were talking about your childhood and the library and what that meant for you. Could you say something? I wonder in terms of children and how they encounter the world.
Yes.
Now, I think it was a different experience when you went to the library and it was...
Yes. I had Mrs. Jewett. She was our librarian. Mm-hmm. And I, as a child, saw her managing this huge library. And I wanted to help her. And so I kind of self-appointed myself as her assistant and helped keep order in that library. And I just loved that library. Just it was like a another home to me, because I was coming from a home that had like the Bible, and maybe one other book, The Jungle Book. Those were the two books that I had.
Now you mean the Rudyard Kipling?
Yes, Rudyard Kipling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those were the parameters of the library at home. And the newspaper. My father had an eighth grade education, and he was a very intelligent man. He was the head of his union. He was the Longshoremen Union, the SIU, and then the ILWU in our town. And so he read the newspaper, and he talked union to us, you know, at the table, and we got to understand the power of unions, you know, that working people actually had a chance and could get health care provisions in their life, you know. And so, yeah, that was so important, that education that I got at the breakfast table, at the dinner table, mm-hmm. from him.
And the library was education.
Yes, the library... you know, I could read at any time. She let me take books home. And my mother, my family was so busy, and I was the oldest child, so I was always trying to help my mother. But I was so seduced by reading that I would be in bed. I would get in bed as if I were ill and take these books to bed, and my mother would open these French doors into the bedroom, and she said, "What are you doing humped up in there with a book?" You know, that was a really scalding remark that I remember yet, you know. But that time with Mrs. Jewett is going to always be with me, you know. And I read, just widely, but also a lot of fun, really fun books like Walter Farley's, the Black Stallion books. Yes. Those were just amazing books.
Yes.
Yeah.
I kind of got caught off guard because I was reading something in here when you were talking about the library, and I was thinking in my mind, I said, that must be that would be my perfect idea. Living close to the forest and wilderness, being not too far from the big water, and then living with books.
That's right.
And that would have been, as a kid, my idea. As a matter of fact, it'd be my idea now.
Yes.
This would be so wonderful. And I kind of got lost for a moment when you were describing it. And then I was in here looking at the way that you were describing you were talking about the ley lines in Ireland and how they connect some disparate areas, like from Ireland to Egypt, the pyramids to Sligo's sacred sites. Yeah. And I was thinking about how synchronicity and wholeness, unity and difference and diffraction all play a part. And I was just having my mind like slowly expanding, just listening to your words here. And I was thinking, how could she have not written this book? It was kind of like, you know, with all this synchronicity going on, it had to be.
Yeah.
It had to be.
Yeah, those passage graves, you know, are very close to where my cottage is. And of course, the light shining in there is kind of famous about how at certain moment, you know, that light strikes through those stones, you know, and it's a very powerful event. I've been up there, and of course, to get in there, it's you have to be more or less small, you know. So children can get in this one particular place that I've been, but I just experience it all from the outside now. But there are powers that are connecting us up, and we don't even know those powers. But we, you know, in being a poet, I try to get hold of it. I try to take it in and then bring it forward again.
Yes.
And that's what each poem is trying to do in the book.
It's as though
excuse me.
You find a different way of connecting, like you described, in the two northwests, but then also the taking ourselves out of ourselves and still seeing ourselves and being ourselves, but being other at the same time. Like when you were describing how the horse was looking at you, and I was thinking about how you're falling into her eye, you know, and to her being, but she's also looking you back at you.
Yes.
So we have a brave soul who has called. And let me get my headphones on. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, am I?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay, I'm on there. Well, first of all, I want to say what a great honor it is to be on the air with the great poet Tess Gallagher. And so that's one reason I had to think of a question, just because of the great honor. So I started writing poetry when I lost my father, and my voice came out. And so one of my favorite poets, of course, is your husband, Raymond Carver, which you had the great honor of being married to.
Yes.
And so my question for you is, for the title of your book, Is Not, I guess I'm wondering how much the person is there with you still, is not, and still is, and how that might differ from, for example, Kierkegaard's either or. It's totally, of course, different. But so I'm just curious what you might say to that.
Ray is with me every day. Every day. He's so important. And I was speaking last night at Powell's about how I built this house, Sky House, and he went there alone, and he wrote 200 poems in that house. It just was so beautiful, and I joined him there, and, I mean, I started to write, too. It was a wonderful occasion, and he was a poet at the same time he was a fiction writer. Those two things developed together. But I do think that our relationship, because we work so closely together, did help his poems develop maybe a bit more. They were kind of slice of life, and I would kind of draw him out and get more, you know, going when I would visit the poem in its drafting stages.
Well, of course, and I would just want to add to your statement just now that Ray didn't live to see this day of the women coming so forth, you know, forward in the world, and at least we are now.
Yes.
And of course, there's the old adage, behind every great man is a woman. We all know that is true. And obviously, it's true for Ray.
I think I was beside him.
Well,
that's how he treated
and,
me, you know.
We were
beside each other.
Exactly. And we're finding out now how true that was for all great people, right up to Einstein and, you know, all these great artists. And
for sure.
Of course, there is this woman in the background just helping, you know, and encouraging and being part of. So
he carried me along too, you know. I was not writing short stories at the time that we met, and my book, The Lover of Horses, he was so proud of that, because he had a hand in encouraging that. And then of course I went on to write At the Owl Woman Saloon after he died, and The Man from Kimbara. So he gave me a lot too.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity, and you are definitely a great poet in your own writing.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you for the show.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
I do want to pay homage to Josie for the beautiful painting on the cover of your book as well.
Thank you.
As we have just a few minutes, what would you like to leave the listeners in either verse or thought?
Well, I think that, you know, this Northwest that we're living in is such a, it's such a wonderful place, and we're on the verge of wilderness here, and that's an entrustment.
Yes, yes,
and,
it is.
And I have the poem I wrote about the gray whales.
Ambition?
Ambition.
Oh, my God, I love it.
Ambition,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, that was beautiful.
I don't know. There's probably not time to read it, but...
Well, we do have a caller. Let's see if we can squeeze in the caller.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Penelope. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you, Tess, for being there, and... I have a question about your poem, Encounter. So beautiful and resonated deeply about finding our differences and being taught, you know, in new places. And there's a kind of spirituality about that. And I wonder if you'd talk more about it. I think we need to find our differences even as a species we're becoming more community-oriented. So I'd like your comments, please.
About being an individual and being in a community. Well, I actually think that both are important. American life emphasizes the individual. And I had to learn community more when I went to Ireland, because I live in a clan spelled C-L-A-N, and that's Josie Gray's family, and he had 8 children. And so everything was decided together. And that was a very wonderful new learning for me.
We want to thank you so much. Our time is gone. So thank you for your call. It has been an absolute pleasure, honor, and expansion to have Tess Gallagher as our guest today. Featuring her book, Is Not. And she is and is not here with us always, bringing us beautiful words of wisdom in our Northwest. Thank you so much.
Thank you both. It's been a real pleasure.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feed to Fire campaign and protest on Thursday, May 23rd at 11 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland. The Feed to Fire campaign is a part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit. This peaceful protest happens every month outside of a different county courthouse and calls for justice of those lost to police violence and hate crimes. Again, that's Feed to Fire campaign and protest on Thursday, May 23rd at 11 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse, 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series. Every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater, Monday, May 20th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Lost in Translation. A lonely, aging movie star and a conflicted newlywed meet in Tokyo. Strangers in a foreign land, the two form a bond that is as unlikely as it is heartful and meaningful. This screening benefits Trash for Peace. Again, that's Lost in Translation, showing Monday, May 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community.